Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
the Elm Street Group at Morgan Stanley, working with clients to create enduring financial value and a lasting impact through sustainable investing solutions. A local wealth management team with global insights. Find out more at the Elm Street Group at morganstanley.com.
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community. With convenient locations throughout northern New England, world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here. And from
New Hampshire Center for Cognitive and Behavioral Therapies, providing outpatient, evidence-based, specialty behavioral health and substance use disorder services. NHCCBT.com.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Football, soccer, and lacrosse dominate the athletic fields of New Hampshire this time of year. Action-packed games that spectators love to watch and kids love to play. But the potential for concussions is also on the minds of many parents and coaches, especially for football. Now a new Boston University study adds fuel to that fire. It says playing tackle football before age 12 exposes children to repetitive head impacts that may double their risk of behavioral problems and triple their chances of depression later in life. Pretty sobering, but as this critique and many others trickle down to the local team level, some adults are pushing back, defending contact sports. They say there are safer ways to play, and they're following those practices. And also that we shouldn't surround kids in bubble wrap so they never get a bump or a bruise. Today in The Exchange, we're looking again at concussions in youth sports, not just at football, but we are going to start there because joining us on the phone is a senior author of that BU study, Dr. Robert Stern. He's director of clinical research at the Chronic Traumatic Encephalopathy Center at BU. And Dr. Stern, welcome. Thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Laura.
We also have three guests in studio, Dr. Stuart Glassman, rehabilitation medicine physician, concussion specialist at Granite Physiatry, medical director of Concord Hospital's Concussion Assessment and Management Program. And Dr. Glassman, welcome back to you, too.
Glad to be here, Laura.
Also with us, Mike Atkins, director of athletics at Keene High School. And Mike, great to see you. Thank you.
Good morning.
And also with us, Teddy Nutting, Kennett High School athletic trainer. Kennett is based in North Conway. And Teddy, thank you for making the trip.
Yeah, super excited to be here.
Well, let's start with you, Dr. Stern. You were quoted in the Boston Globe as saying, based on logic and common sense and the growing totality of research, I don't think kids should be playing tackle football. What's been the reaction, Dr. Stern, since you first made that statement about a week ago?
Yeah, it's been surprisingly positive. There's always a lot of people who, no matter what, just want to keep going with our pastime in this country and have our kids get into the field and have their heads hit. But for the most part, from parents, from former professional players, former college players, I keep getting response after response that say, wow, thank you for actually saying that.
There's been a lot written, and I know you know this, about how CTE can only be determined after death with autopsy. How did you reach your conclusions about the impact of youth football, not just concussions, but, you know, repeated subconcussive hits, as they're called? How did you figure this out?
Yeah, well, this was definitely not a study of CTE because of the reason you just said. Yeah, we're working all the time on trying to figure out how to diagnose that neurodegenerative disease during life. But right now, it really can only be diagnosed after death. So this was really a study of the relationship between getting your head hit repeatedly through tackle football during childhood and later life functioning, not this disease. And so what we did was we examined 214 individuals who were participants in our ongoing LEGEND study. And these folks were all former amateur and professional American football players. And they included 43 players who only played through high school football, 103 who played only through college, and then 68 who also played professionally. So we then divided them into two groups, those who started playing tackle football before age 12 and those who started playing at 12 or older. And all those subjects, those participants, completed a bunch of telephone-administered cognitive tests, and they completed these online measures and questionnaires of depression, of behavioral regulation, of what's called apathy, the lack of motivation, as well as something called executive functioning, or initiating activity, problem-solving, planning, and organization. So they all did that, and we analyzed the data and found that the former players who started playing tackle football before the age of 12 were at 3 times the risk for later life elevated scores, clinically elevated scores on the depression measures, and twofold increased problems with behavioral regulation and apathy and that executive functioning.
Were you surprised, Dr. Stern, by this?
No, I wasn't. I was concerned, but I wasn't surprised, because this followed previous research from our center that looked at only professional football players. And that was a couple different publications a year or two ago, where we only looked at former NFL players. And we found in one study that the guys who started playing football before age 12 had significantly worse cognitive functioning and executive impairment and memory. And then another study, they also had changes in the structure of their brain and what's called the corpus callosum, the big white matter fibers that connect the left and right hemispheres.
So what is it about the brain, Dr. Stern, under 12, over 12? Why does that matter so much in terms of brain development and how much the brain gets, you know, shook around in those early years?
Well, you know, it's not a magic number. 12 is,
sure, everybody's different.
Development doesn't know, poof, I turned 12, therefore. But what's going on and what we based our studies on was previous research that shows that the brain is undergoing these key periods of development and maturation, where several brain structures and functions reach their peak development during the period leading up to age 12, at least in boys. And so that's why we initially chose that cutoff. But we also looked at other age cutoffs just to make sure. So we looked at 11, age 13. We also looked at just the overall continuum of age and found the same thing, that the younger they started, the worse the later life outcomes. And overall, age 12 as a cutoff resulted in the most robust findings. But it seems to be that there may be this period of neurodevelopmental vulnerability leading up to that period in puberty, where if you hit your head over and over again, it may result in long-term problems.
Well, one aspect of this that jumped out at me, Dr. Stern, from your study is it's not just concussions that you're talking about. It's repetitive head impacts that can cause a problem. So even if your kid never has a concussion, he or she could suffer some damage.
Right. This wasn't a study of concussion at all. And most of our research and research from other groups looking at long-term consequences, you know, people in middle age or later age, find that it's not concussions, those symptomatic injuries, but rather these subconcussive hits where the brain gets moved around quickly, rapidly inside that hard skull, inside a helmet, where there may not be any symptoms of concussion. And those types of hits can happen on average in around 200, 300 times in a youth football player, and much more than that in higher level players.
Okay, so speaking...
So we're really concerned about those repetitive hits that don't necessarily result in symptoms of concussion.
Even when the kid says, no, I feel fine. Speaking of youth football, Pop Warner, the country's most prominent youth football league, disputed your findings, saying the greatest evidence against this study, I'm quoting here, may be in the millions of successful individuals who played youth football and went on to become leaders in society, you know, teachers and judges and, you know, law enforcement officers and all sorts of other professions. So how do you feel about that point, Dr. Stern?
Well, two things. One is that we did not examine people who only played youth football in this study. These were people who started either before 12 or after 12, but then went on to play high school, college or professional football. So it's not a study of people who just played youth football. But the other part is that's like kind of saying, I know so many people who smoked like chimneys and they're living to age 80 and 90 and never had cancer. It's a silly argument to say there's a lot of people who are doing great and therefore there's no problem.
This is a weird place for you, right, Dr. Stern? I read that one of your sons played football as a kid.
Hey, I was wondering if you were going to bring that up.
Yeah, of course.
My eldest son, who's now 28, played Pop Warner football and then high school football. He was a pretty good varsity player in the infamous Needham-Wellesley football team, the oldest rivalry in the football game, the oldest rivalry in the country. And when he heard that I had brought him up in any of these interviews, he responded to me from email saying, "You remember that I started at 13?
After 12.
That's
yeah.
Right. But he did that before I got into this, before we knew anything really about CTE. And so I have to rethink that now. And I can understand, therefore, how parents feel that it is an incredible experience to watch your kids play. It's an incredible thing to see the camaraderie and the teamwork. But now I realize there are other ways to have camaraderie, to have teamwork, to have the athleticism, other than putting our kids on fields with these big helmets that make them kind of bobbleheads and say, go at it, hit your heads 100, 200, 300, 400 times in a season before they're age 12. That doesn't make sense to me.
Hold on for a sec, Dr. Stern, please. I want to bring our other guests in for a moment, especially you, Dr. Glassman. How do you view this research as a doctor and as a football dad yourself?
Right, right. So certainly, again, the risk of head injury, the younger you are, clearly the more risk you have for later life issues. And those people that became judges and successful businessmen may have had emotional issues that were not part of what Pop Warner talked about. So it wasn't an exclusive. If you were successful later in life, you had no emotional problems related to football. So I don't know the Pop Warner's reasoning is really the perfect answer to the opposite viewpoint of this issue. And again, I had two sons that played football, started at ages 9, and this was in 2008, 2009. My middle son, Eric, was New Hampshire's Defensive Player of the Year 3 years ago and was offered the chance to play college football. And we decided, based upon all that we knew, to not do that.
You were pretty unpopular in your house.
No. I mean, we were very fortunate because not everyone gets concussions, Dr. Stern, and many of the researchers know that we see definitely an issue and a problem. But it's not 100% across the board to every person that ever puts on a helmet.
Sure.
But it's enough of an issue. 20% of, kids have concussions based upon some recent studies that came out, whatever the sport is, that you have to be aware that there's a risk involved. And there are other ways to get the, social and teamwork and camaraderie through other sports where you don't have to get your head hit as many times. I will tell you a quick story. So I was a videographer for my children's youth football team when all this was starting in 2009, 2010.
So you've got video of some of these.
I filmed, my son was a defensive lineman. I filmed plays where you see his helmet hit the other helmet of the offensive lineman 3 times in one play.
Ouch.
Multiply that by every play, every game, every practice at that time. And to me, it was an awakening that it's not about the concussions only, by any means. It's about what else is going on. And from that moment forward, I looked at my son every day from practice and from games, and I checked him out. I was able to do that as a physician and as a dad. For any of you that have your children playing, if you have a camera where you can really zoom in, slow it down. Once you film it, look at it later. Put it in slow motion. You'll see what it is that we're talking about scientifically on your own football field in your own town.
Well, and Dr. Glassman, I invited you back because, you're one of the state's leading experts on this. So I mostly want to talk to you about your professional opinion.
Sure,
but
sure.
I have to ask you personally, what was like for you to tell your son, no, you can't play college football? I mean, that's a dream for a lot of young people.
Well, I mean, it was a situation where we both came to that decision because the opportunities that were offered to him were probably not going to be ideal. In other words, you know, he wasn't getting a scholarship. He could play, but no scholarship. Now, at this point, 2 years later, 3.6 GPA cum laude in college, no ongoing headaches, no emotional issues in school as a junior. I think we made the right choice.
So I've got two folks here also at the high school level. Yep. So I want to turn to you as well, Mike Atkinson-Keene and Teddy Nutting at Kennett High School. How about you, Mike, first? How do you react to this research that has come out of BU just recently on kids under 12 just shouldn't do it?
Yeah, I have two comments on that. In the city of Keene, we have a youth program, which is with tackle football. They do minimal contact during practice, so most of the contact is during games. And we watch that pretty closely. There's approximately 100 youth from between 8 and 13, ages 8 and 13 in Keene, that play tackle football. But we've also started a flag football program that the Keene Rec Department has started. So if students want to have that team experience without the potential contact, flag football is the other way to go.
So that's another option that people are looking at. And we're going to talk throughout the hour of other options, other ways to both practice and play. But just your broad reaction, Teddy Nutting. Again, you're an athletic trainer for Kennett High School. I wonder what you think.
There is a youth football league called the Mountaineers in Conway. And it's probably starts at 12 to that 14 age before they get into middle school. And I'm not sure how much hitting they're really doing. But I do love that the study that Dr. Stearns is talking about, that micro trauma versus that macro trauma and that big event where you're actually having symptoms where you're having cognitive issues, balance, motor control stuff versus those little hits that eventually add up. The National Athletic Training Conference that I went to in Houston this summer, that was a huge thing that they talked about during any of the concussion ones that I went to, is the micro trauma and how it adds up and eventually like leads to those mental health issues, and there's things that they're looking at.
Wow, so a lot of attention to this idea that Dr. Stern talked about. It isn't just the big concussions that send you off the field and send you home. It's these small hits repeatedly. Dr. Stern, last question for you. You know, going over the research yesterday, a lot of researchers in this field say there's still so much we don't know about head impacts, about concussions. What more do you wish you knew, Dr. Stern?
Oh, boy. Do you have another 2 hours?
Yeah.
So one of the most important things we need to do is to be able to figure out how to measure those little, quote, micro hits or the subconcussive trauma, to be able to detect what's going on in the brain. So we know what is an important hit or not, whether regardless of symptoms. So we need some kind of objective marker to be able to say, aha, that person has had too many hits. Let's do something about it. You know, compare it to Little League, where we have a pitch count. We just count the number of pitches that a pitcher takes, and then we take them out so they can't hurt their elbows, so they can't, you know, hurt their chances of becoming a pro pitcher when they're 7 years old. So that's one thing, is to have some kind of objective measure. But the most important thing for me, because really the majority of my research focuses on the neurodegenerative disease of chronic traumatic encephalopathy, is we need to be able to figure out how to diagnose it during life. And, you know, we've made some baby steps toward that. I'm overseeing a large seven-year, $16 million research project across the country, where that's the whole goal, is to try to figure out how to diagnose CTE during life. Because once we can do that, once we can detect that and maybe even detect it earlier in life, then we can figure out how common this problem is, perhaps what the actual risk factors are, including genetics, and then most importantly, be able to do things to treat it and ultimately prevent it.
Well, Dr. Stern, we'll check back in with you on that. It's really interesting, and I really appreciate you taking time out for us this morning.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That's Dr. Robert Stern, Director of Clinical Research at the CTE Center at Boston University, senior author of that study we've been talking about, linking youth football with a greater risk of later mental health problems. You're listening to The Exchange on NHPR. You can join us with a phone call now at 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Dr. Glassman, I know you wanted to jump in there while Dr. Stern was wrapping up.
Yep. So I think the issue to understand is, especially for treating patients, you have to ask the questions that get to the issues of emotional, behavioral, cognitive issues. So, you know, you have a kid that comes in that might not really talk about how bad he's feeling. Clinically, you have to ask the right question to let that student athlete feel comfortable talking about what they may not tell their coaches or their teammates. I think there's a nuanced way of doing that as you treat, you know, these patients, both male and female. You know?
Well, and that's the thing. And let's talk to you too, Teddy and Mike, about this. This is part of the problem, isn't it, Teddy? I mean, you know, we can sit here and say we should. But if a kid doesn't want to go off the field, Teddy, he might make stuff up.
Yeah, absolutely.
He or she.
I mean, at the high school level, most of the kids now, I think with all of this information coming out, that they're way more likely to report symptoms. And I'm seeing that at my level for sure. And it's making my job a little bit easier now that they're actually reporting symptoms opposed to kids kind of getting those concussive hits or subconcussive hits and kind of brushing it off their shoulder as if nothing's happening. They're way more apt to say, hey, you know what, I got hit in that last play, but I'm feeling fine. Would you mind running me through maybe like a balance test or something like that to make sure? Or they're definitely more aware of what's going on.
So that's a good thing.
It's a good thing.
Has that changed in the time that you've been doing this work?
Absolutely. Yeah, I'd say it's changed within the last 2 years. And I think that's one reason why, and I'll talk about it later on, with how we've decreased concussions a little bit at the high school at Kennett. Even with people reporting symptoms and stuff more, we've actually seen less. But I think that's due to just the awareness.
Well, and so to this point, here's an email that I got this morning from Scott, who's a certified athletic trainer like you, Teddy. Now, Scott, this is long, so I'm not going to read the whole thing, but he says, concussion return to play protocols have made many drastic changes in the past decade since I was first certified. In the good old days, Scott says, if you had a concussion during a game and the symptoms resolved within 15 minutes, you were allowed back in the game. Scott says, the high school I'm contracted now with does baseline impact testing on all incoming freshmen, retests them when they are juniors as well. When a student is suspected of having a concussion, they're pulled from activity and evaluated by me. And then Scott then describes that whole evaluation, a long return to play protocol. He then says, and I'll throw this to you, Mike, he says, the biggest challenge for me has been educating parents, coaches, and even doctors. Some parents think just because the doctor cleared them, they can get right back into the game the next day. Sometimes we have to call the doctor's office, tell them what we're seeing, because the athletes have figured out that as long as you tell the doctor you're feeling okay, they'll sign a note clearing them. And Scott says he has to be the bad guy sometimes. Do you have to sometimes be the bad guy?
As the athletic director, absolutely. I take on some of that heat at our high school. We have the same return to play protocol, a five-step process, which is under a neurologist, and we're actually connected with Dartmouth Hitchcock. So we have a neurologist who is, quote, on staff, who looks at all our baseline testing. But often, all the decision about return to play is passed on to the athletic office, to me as the athletic director. And it's we always err on the side of caution. I will say that.
And Scott describes, it's a long process. I didn't realize until he sent his email. Go ahead.
It's a five-step process, which doesn't necessarily mean 5 days. It could be 7 or 8 or 9 days. Each athlete who's returning to play has to complete each step in a progression. So it can sometimes be 2 weeks. We're dealing with a young man. We've had two concussions on our varsity football team at Keene High School this year. We're dealing with a young man right now who's in his second week on the return to play protocol. And we're watching him very closely. I mean, we won't put any student in a situation where there's a chance of immediate chance of re-injury.
All right. Well, we will talk a lot more after a short break. Scott, thank you for that email. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
Pay for high-quality journalism in New Hampshire by becoming a new NHPR sustaining member at just $10 a month. As our thanks, we'll send you a special thank you gift, an NHPR mug, and a pair of NHPR socks that both feature the majestic purple finch. Setting up your sustaining gift is quick and easy to do at nhpr.org. And thanks.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in the Exchange, reconsidering contact sports, not just football, but soccer, lacrosse, hockey. There's been an avalanche of research lately about impacts on the young brain of repeated hits to the head. But also, some parents and coaches have been pushing back a little bit, wondering if the worry has gone overboard, that in general, the benefit of these sports outweigh the risks, especially if they're played safely. We're looking at all this, and we wonder what you think. Give us a call, the Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. We have three guests for the hour. Teddy Nutting is here. He's an athletic trainer at Kennett High School in North Conway. Mike Atkins is with us, director of athletics at Keene High School. And Dr. Stuart Glassman, a rehabilitation medicine physician, concussion specialist, and medical director of Concord Hospital's Concussion Assessment and Management Program. One more time, that number for you to join us with your comments and questions about this, 1-800-892-6477. So, gentlemen, lots of focus on football, you know, all the attention on the NFL and the research we heard about from Boston University. But, Teddy, to you first, what other sports should we be studying just as thoroughly as football is being studied right now?
I know that the FIFA League, who is the group that monitors professional soccer, is one thing that at the high school level, soccer is probably one of the either the first or the second leading in concussions for kind of high school. I don't know if the reason is because they're heading the ball so often, but a lot of the stuff that happens is, so say for our JV players, most of those people don't do a lot of things over the summer, whereas their varsity players are spending the extra time, they're doing strengthening, they're doing putting in a lot of extra work to be conditioned for the sport. So in a lot of those lower level sports, say, you'll see kids falling over who get more like whiplash injuries because they're not able to maybe like stabilize through their core or their neck, things like that. Just lack of control with their bodies, they're growing into themselves, coordination issues, things like that. I'd say that that's probably one of the most leading sports for
that's interesting. And I have heard, and maybe you can shine some light on this, maybe Dr. Glassman, that girls soccer is, after football, some people say, is the second leading cause of concussion.
Right. And part of the reason is, especially, you know, younger age, if you talk about when heading the ball was allowed, well, with girls who were young and their neck musculature wasn't really developed, the head was sustaining all of the impact of a ball coming, you know, through the air, not the neck muscles. So that's why you started to see that actually girls soccer was, you know, really the second. I think maybe girls ice hockey was actually second, but girls soccer was actually third, or very close to that, because of those physiologic issues for you know, teenage girls, basically.
Now I'm going to show my lack of knowledge about soccer. So do kids soccer still? Do they still do headers?
Well, the recommendations now are to not do any heading of the ball till at least age 14, because that's come out of some of the research that's been looking at concussion issues in soccer players. So it really is a recommendation to avoid any heading in practice or in games till that age, you know, for sure.
So is that recommendation being followed, Mike?
Yeah, at the youth level in the area, heading is prohibited. We really teach how to, but the students really don't do it. The youth really don't do it. At the high school level, it's still in play at the JV and varsity level. We do some training for our athletes on strengthening the neck musculature, as Dr. Glassman talked about. Especially in preseason, we help those students strengthen the neck muscles, which helps stabilize the head, which prevents that movement of the brain in the, you know, in the skull.
Wow. So at the high school level, you still do headers,
do.
But at the lower levels,
they
people
really
don't do it
anymore.
Yeah. How about in North Conway, Teddy?
I'd say that all levels. Probably not in the there's an MWV soccer league that's like under 12. I'd assume that they don't. I'm not really sure, actually. That'd be something to look into.
How do you think, maybe to you first, Dr. Glassman, how aware do you think parents are of these risks of, you know, repeated hits to the head in other sports, given that there's been an overwhelming focus on football?
Oh, much more so compared to 5 years ago, for sure, because what they understand is that, you know, a person's brain doesn't care how it gets injured. It doesn't matter whether it's football, cheerleading, soccer, lacrosse, basketball. So I think any contact or collision sport, if you're a parent, you are aware of the fact that there's always a risk, some greater certain contact collision sports versus others. But the education has been on a pretty significant level, especially in New Hampshire, from the, you know, youth recreation leagues to the middle schools to the high schools, that whether your kid played, you know, football or as a cheerleader, you've heard someone that suffered an injury at some point. And so I think parents are looking for it more because they've heard about CTE. They've heard about kids that have killed themselves, you know, in high school and college 3 days after a concussion. So they know that it's very serious.
Wow. Because yeah. of the mental health problems that can result from concussion.
Or sometimes I think in the cases that, you know, have been talked about, you know, in the news media that, you know, and the emotional component is the issue of any of the factors, even though, you know, dizziness and vestibular problems are the ones that predict longer recovery. It's really the emotional issues that can really go out of control so fast that you have to be aware of it. And I think parents understand that.
Well, and Mike, I was, again, looking at all the different sports yesterday, and you guys mentioned soccer, hockey. We've talked about football, lacrosse. I heard about wrestling. Is also a concern now. Now, why is that? You're not, you know, bouncing around, really.
Yeah, in the sport of wrestling, they're obviously wrestling on a mat, so there is some
right,
you know, safety precautions.
And they've got
place.
Little helmets on.
The helmets are really to cover the ears, not necessarily to protect the brain.
I see.
But, it's when there's a takedown, when a student, the goal of the sport is to take the other your opponent down on the mat, and when that happens, sometimes they come down hard on the head. And, you know, that again, that jarring, that bouncing motion potentially can be a problem.
And cheerleading, I've read a lot about, too. And you would think, OK, cheerleading, how could that possibly be? But then
as Dr. Glassman said, at Keene High School last winter, we had cheerleading was our number one sport with concussions. We had 4 concussions out of approximately 18 cheerleaders. Mm-hmm. And that's when they're doing the lifts, when they're doing the stunts. There's sometimes injury. Sometimes the athlete goes down.
Yeah, especially in flyers where there's going up right. in the air and right. being caught and something right. happens and either the base person gets hit by the flyer or the right. flyer gets dropped or,
yeah.
you know.
And just remember in the state of New Hampshire, there's 2 different levels of cheering. There's cheering on the sideline, you know, at the basketball game, for instance, but there's also a competitive cheer component. And that's where we sometimes see when they're doing the tricks is what they call them.
Right.
Sometimes we see injury.
Wow. You learn something new every day. I did not know. I mean, I knew that cheerleading had some risks given that there's a lot of gymnastics involved these days and people are doing fabulous flips and twists in the air yep. and coming down. But I did not realize that it was such a high level of concussion, at least at your school.
Becoming more and more technical and you know, and competitive.
The number for you to join us again is 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. You can always respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. Again, 1-800-892-6477. What do you think about this accumulating research showing the impact of repeated head injury, not just concussions, but subconcussive impacts as well? What do you think is appropriate concern? What do you think is going overboard? We'd love to hear from you. 1-800-892-6477. That's the question I want to ask all of you before we go to our listeners. And Teddy, to you first. So I've been reading also about some parents and coaches saying, look, we can't put bubble wrap around our kids. We're going a little bit overboard with this. Not everybody's going to have, you know, major head trauma. Kids should get, you know, they shouldn't live their lives without getting banged up a little bit, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I just wonder how you sort that out, that, you know, kids should be out there playing. You know, there's damages to staying home playing video games all day, too.
Yeah,
so
yeah,
just how do you figure that out?
I feel like most of the concussions or the head injuries that I've had haven't been people directly in part of a play. It's been completely accidental. Like somebody who's off to the side of the play tripping and then getting kneed in the helmet or something like that, opposed to a big one hit. That seems to be the trend in almost all the sports. It's usually somebody trips over themselves and they hit their head off the ground.
Which would happen anyway.
It happened anyway, you know what I mean? There's not much that you can do to prevent it. But one thing that we are doing, I mean, Kenneth does a really good job, and Vaughn Beckwith, who's the head football coach, and getting new equipment. They just got that new Insight sensor that tells you when there's a... what it does is it just measures the movement of the helmet, and if there's above a 1%, it gives you a little bit of a almost like a, I don't know what to call it, like
a measurement.
It measures it, but then it gives you an alert system.
Oh.
And tells you which person with their helmet, which number, the player's name, and that way, if you get those above 1% hits, you can pull that person out and say, make sure to do like an evaluation on that kid. It also, after 5 of those sub 1%, it'll also give you an alert. So that's one thing that we're, the coaches are changing their practices, what they're doing for hitting. If they notice that, okay, this one kid keeps getting that below 1% hit, what time during practice are they getting that hit? And what practice or what thing are we doing in practice that we could maybe take out of practice to prevent that person from getting hit?
Well, so you're getting data right there from the field, from inside the helmet.
Inside the helmet, yep.
Wow, and if a kid says, we talked about this earlier, if a kid says, look, coach, I feel fine, don't take me out, you can look at the data and say, uh-uh, you were hit pretty hard,
exactly.
You're out.
Exactly, yeah, exactly. And then just make sure to at least put the person through an evaluation and say, all right, I can see that you're fine. So it's really helpful seeing as how there's not a super objective way to diagnose a concussion sometimes, unless you're just getting those symptoms that people are reporting, like headache, things that you can't really see.
Sure.
So that's one. It's a tool that helps us out as athletic trainers in evaluating a student.
Wow. And again, getting at those repeated hits that may not be concussive, but
yeah. So after 5 of those micro traumas, it tells you kind of check up on this kid or look at what you're doing in practice, something that you might need to change. So it's very, very helpful. One thing that we talked about at the National Athletic Training Conference was hopefully within the next couple of years, those biomarkers that are found in blood tests after a head injury. I really hope that there's more research comes out on that, because that would be so helpful for me as an athletic trainer to be able to send a kid to their primary care and say, you know what, your blood test came up positive for that biomarker. You for sure have a head injury.
Yeah, that's something else that Boston University is working on, which is really exciting. Dr. Stern touched on that. Go ahead, Dr. Glassman.
Yep, so a couple of things. Obviously, you know, we can't avoid life as a contact sport sometimes. So obviously,
yeah, this bubble wrap thing. I mean, you know,
yep.
How protective do we want to be, really?
Right, so I think the issue is that it's really about letting kids and parents understand that if something does happen, at least get it assessed the right way. Be honest about what you're feeling. Tell, you know, your coaches, your parents, what your symptoms are, because at least that way you're able to have it treated appropriately and recover quickly. The worst thing you can do is not tell anybody anything, because you want to stay involved in the game. And then you have another injury, and before you know it, your head's been hit 3 times before you let anybody know. And then at that point, well, you're going to be out 4 weeks probably versus being out, you know, 2 weeks. A lot of research has shown that high school and middle school kids, the average recovery is 4 weeks. It's not 7 to 10 days like adults may have previously.
That's most of the season, though, for some sports.
For some sports, it can be a majority of the season, and it's important. But the bigger issue, remember, we're talking about, you know, student athletes. They're going to be students much longer than they're going to be athletes. Someone who gets a concussion in April is in a real risk of having problems when finals come along in June, or SAT exams or PSAT exams. So we've got to be talking about the whole issue of return to school aside from return to play, because, you know, the percentage of high school athletes that go on to play in college or professional at any sport is the minority, and a very small percentage.
Well, here's an email that came in from Rob, who says, as a person who started playing football at 8 and has every horrible symptom described by the doctor here and elsewhere, I think he's referring to Dr. Stern, who talked earlier about the impact of youth football. Rob says, I would also be one of those leaders that Pop Warner is touting. Successful adults and players who exhibit issues, depression, cognitive issues in their private life are not mutually exclusive. All that said, Rob says, as a long-term player, coach, and now father, the good things that football gave me would still make me somewhat ambivalent to tell my child no without a lot of thought. He says, fortunately, that is not an issue for us. Rob, thank you so much for the email. You're listening to The Exchange on NHPR. And gentlemen, let's go to some calls. And Jack joins us from Keene. Hi, Jack. Go ahead. You're on the air. Thanks for being with us.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Sure.
Mr. Atkins, I was a football player under you last season.
Hi, Jack.
And I just want to know, like, considering my head injury last season that resulted in me no longer being able to play football, what is Keen specifically, as well as Kenan, doing along with Dr. Glassman's research to and other research to improve concussion protocol and preventative measures?
Yeah. And Jack, sorry to hear what happened to you.
Oh, no, it's okay. It's part of the game.
Okay. Thank you so much for calling in. Go ahead.
Yeah, that's a great question. We've put in a number of measures to make the sport as safe as possible, minimize contact. So things like minimizing the amount of live contact to an hour and a half a week. So during practice, exactly right. Hour and a half a week. And that's maximum. Many times during the week, our team is doing less than that. We've gone to helmetless tackle drills, which, again, minimizes contact.
No, we've talked about that on this show before, but just remind us what that is, because that's interesting.
It just helps teach our athletes to not lead with their helmet, you know, not lead with their head, to tackle with the shoulders, to grab with arms. We've modeled this out of what they call hawk tackling, which was developed by the Seattle Seahawks defensive staff, and we've taught it to our coaches. And really, it's modeled after rugby tackling, obviously in rugby, they don't wear helmets. And it's about tackling with the arms, tackling with the shoulders, and minimizing the head contact. And we've done a lot more tackling on pads, and we actually have a device called a Shadow Man, which was similar to what Dartmouth developed with their robotic tackling dummy. We don't have a robotic one, but we have one that we can move via a strap, so we can practice tackling full speed, but not on a body. You know, we're tackling on a dummy, on something which minimizes impact.
So I've heard about this. I want to get you in too, Teddy, but I've heard about, you know, helmetless tackling and tackling more with the rest of your body.
Right.
But still, when you go down, you know, if a tackle is successful, Mike, and, you know, I go down, I'm hitting the ground pretty hard. Couldn't I get a concussion from that as well?
Certainly possible. And that would be possible in any sport, as we've talked about.
Sure.
In soccer and lacrosse and wrestling, as we talked about earlier.
But in those sports, the goal isn't so much to knock people down.
With the exception of wrestling, I guess. But yes,
yeah.
That's true. What I've experienced, where I see the biggest contact is, as Dr. Glassman said, you know, the helmet on helmet with whether it's tackling or blocking. I think that's when we see a lot more of the contact. Or I've also seen cases of helmet on knee, for instance, where a ball carrier is running the ball, knee comes up and hits the forehead of the helmet, and that's the trauma that could potentially be a problem.
I see. I'd love to hear what you're doing too, Teddy.
Yeah, so like I mentioned before, Kennett has all of the most up-to-date helmets. So the equipment that they're buying is one thing that's going to be helping out. And then similar to that kind of dummy that you guys have, Kennett has a thing called a tackle wheel, which it's pretty much like a foam donut that's like 50 pounds or so. So when they roll it, the kids learn to tackle, look at the donut, and make sure that they see which way it's going, so that way they can get their head out of the way and tackle across the body, opposed to getting in front of it where their head's at risk.
It's interesting. It sounds like football may be a completely different sport 10 years from now. Still fun to watch, but done very differently. We will talk more in just a moment. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, kids and contact sports. Football and concussions and CTE have received most of the attention, but other contact sports can also cause head injury. We're looking at all the research and evolving practices and asking also what's appropriate concern and what may be going overboard. Join us with your questions, comments, suggestions. Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. Again, 1-800-892-6477. And Dr. Glassman, Mike Atkins, Teddy Nutting, let's go right back to our listeners. Mary joins us from Hanover. Hi, Mary, go ahead. You're in The Exchange. Welcome.
Hi. I was wondering why boxing wasn't mentioned. I would think that would have been in the highest.
Right. No, that is way up there, Mary. Thank you. And I think the focus of our show today is on youth sports and concussions because of the research coming out of BU. But Dr. Glassman, I know boxing is way up there. Mary's right.
Well, the whole point of boxing is to induce a concussion in your opponent so that exactly. you knock him out or the you win the match. But certainly, rules for boxing have evolved over the last 20 years because of deaths in the ring and the concern about ongoing head injuries. So certainly, without a doubt, boxing, I think probably it's because the number of people that are boxing is probably so much less than people playing, kids playing soccer or football or hockey, which is likely why it doesn't hit the top of the list. But certainly, as far as the incidents, well, it's probably the highest because you're trying
That's
to hit
it's
someone
all
in the head. Exactly.
Right.
And I would argue that Muhammad Ali, who was a pretty, popular figure in pop culture, when he came up with CTE and his current condition, that I think boxing is less popular now than it was 20 years ago because of Muhammad Ali and his situation.
Sure. And Mary, again, the reason why we weren't talking about it is our focus today is on kids' sports, contact sports for children, and all the research and how some of the practices are evolving. So thank you for chiming in, Mary. Here's an email from Logan in Exeter who says, what do the statistics show regarding CTE and contact sports with helmets, football, hockey, lacrosse, she says, versus contact sports without helmets? Do helmets make us think we are safer so we go for bigger hits? Or is the issue really any sort of contact? Logan says, this makes me think of pushing my kids toward non-contact sports, just as swimming, track, and field. Logan, thank you for the email. And all of you, maybe you first, Teddy. What do you think?
I think that with all the technology that they're coming out with helmets, it definitely makes the kids feel pretty safe. I mean, how many pounds does a helmet weigh, do you think? Like seven?
Well, I think 4.5, 5 pounds probably.
Yeah, yep. 5. Yep. So, for the kids to be wearing that on their head, like the strain that goes on their neck, and on top of that, it's just with that much protection or like
quote unquote,
what seems like they have for protection. I think it does make kids feel pretty safe opposed to like, say, rugby. There's more facial injuries and stuff like that in rugby than there is concussions from the research that I've read.
So, but should they feel safer? I think that's Logan's point. Is it giving
them a
false
sense
of security?
I don't think that they should feel safer at all.
Okay.
I don't think so.
Mike?
I can give Logan some statistics. So, fall 2016-2017, so last fall, at Keene High School, we had 22 concussions. 10 of those were in football. But 11 of those were in other sports, 4 in girls soccer, 4 in cheer, 1 in volleyball, 1 in boys soccer, 1 in field hockey, and 1 to a student who was training for another season. So, all those other sports are non-helmeted sports. So to answer Logan's question, does it make a student or an athlete feel safer to have a helmet on and therefore exacerbate the injury rate or the potential for injury rate? I'm not sure.
So false sense of security, maybe yes,
maybe
no?
Maybe yes, maybe no.
What do you think, Dr. Glassman, about Logan's second point? She says, all this makes me feel like pushing my kids toward non-contact sports, such as swimming and track and field.
Right. So I have a patient right now, 16-year-old male, who plays lacrosse, hockey, and football. So.
Wow, the big three,
the
basically.
Big three. So now it's been 9 months since his concussion. And I'm like, you know what? You don't have to have 2 or 3 more for me to know your brain doesn't like getting injured. So crew, rowing, track and field. Let's talk about other sports that are in a team environment that your head is not at risk of getting hit. I'm having those conversations. We've been having them for years. I would say we're having them more often now, earlier, because of the fact that we know back in, 5 years ago, 3 concussions in a season, or, 5 before age 18, and it was too many. Now, if someone has 1 concussion that takes months to recover, we're saying, okay, let's talk about this. Because if it happens again, that's another, injury to your brain that we don't know how quickly you recover or what the long-term issues will be. So we definitely are talking about non-contact sport alternatives to allow for the camaraderie, to allow, kids to be doing stuff, without the, higher risk of head injuries that go along with contact or collision sports. So we have those conversations regularly now.
How do you feel about that? I mean, is it sort of... are we being overprotective? Are we, you know, going to lose something? You know, I mean, soccer's a great sport. You know, football, oh my gosh. I mean, how many people watch football? So many. So
well, I think that there's, you know, more science, more knowledge is important. And if you're willing to accept for what it tells you, even though it's not an ideal research, you know, environment, or you have a self-selected population of athletes for CTE because they are dead and they played helmeted sports. Sure, you could always find reasons to sort of, you know, strike down what the sort of outcome and the theory of the research is. But I think we're at a point now, we've had so much information over the last decade that you have to be able to accept the fact that playing a sport where your head gets injured is a risk and it has lifelong implications. And therefore, talking about that stuff early, I mean, I'll never forget, I had a 15-year-old hockey player from Vermont came to my office 5 years ago. This is after three NHL hockey players killed themselves, all within a span of 3 weeks.
Wow.
And he was 15 years old. He had five concussions. He was one of the best hockey players in Vermont and said to me, am I going to kill myself? So he got it. He understood at that age. We talked about it, and he switched out of contact sports, track and field, set state records, came back 4 years later and said, I feel great. I don't have any more emotional anxiety issues. Can I play hockey? And I said, over my dead body. I said, why?
Wow.
Because we saved you. We saved you from where you were heading. And now to put you on that path again, I said, you're my son. There's no way I'm ever doing that. And he listened.
I have heard that, and correct me if I'm wrong, Dr. Glassman, yeah, that the second concussion and the third concussion, like that's really where some of the mental health issues kick in, you know, suicidal thoughts, depression, and so forth.
I mean, every case is individual. You could have one concussion that takes a year and a half to recover, and I've had patients like that,
wow,
friends
of ours.
That's a
long time.
It's a long time. You can have other cases where kids have three concussions, each one takes 1 week to recover, their impact tests never go below baseline, and their parents are begging me to tell them to stop playing that sport. And I'm like, his brain is probably better equipped to deal with this just because of what we're seeing in those recoveries. So as a general rule, I would say the more concussions, the worse outcome you'll probably have. There's always individual variants and stories of, and obviously I'm not seeing that person 20, 30, 40 years later. But multiple concussions in general will definitely lead to more problems down the road.
That's why it would be so helpful to have some of that blood testing that give us an idea and so forth. You know, what do you think, Mike? Dr. Glassman talked about this sort of trend of, like Logan, a parent saying, maybe I just want to avoid these sports. I mean, is that going overboard?
We have to keep in mind that, you know, the place of sports in our culture. And you know, I'll speak again at the high school level. Sports play a vital role with some of our kids in helping them find some level of success, helping them find out who they are. So and with a sport like football, given, you know, where that is in our culture, you have to weigh the risk versus, you know, kind of the acceptance of being an athlete at the high school level. I think as coaches and administrators, we try to counsel our kids as best we can. What's the best path to take for each individual student?
So could we have it all? Could we have these fantastic sports, you know, soccer, lacrosse, you know, football? So many people love it. Could we do it without the harm that we've all talked about?
I would say we can't eliminate 100% of the risk, as Dr. Glassman mentioned, but I think we can put policies and procedures in place that make it as safe as possible. And that's, you know, that's the best we can do at this time. With further research, I think we can even do better.
You're listening to The Exchange on NHPR. Here's an email from Grace and Henniker who says, why not focus more attention on ways to prevent head injury, not to diagnose after the fact? So I'll ask you about that, Teddy. Grace also says, also mention head injury in skiing and biking, especially mountain biking. Nothing is without risk, and I'm a big biker myself, and once in a while I do fall off my bicycle. So I hear you, Grace. What about this, though? There's so much attention, Teddy, on post-concussion protocol and so forth. What about prevention? I mean, you've talked about it, but I'd love to hear a little bit more.
Yeah, so I mean, one thing that we've been doing with the football team over the summer is they've hired Mountain Center, who's the company that I work for, to do all of their strength and conditioning. And I think that's I think that's part of the reason that we've had fewer concussions. Is the kids are way stronger, they're way more fit. They're working on neck stabilizers. They're working on building neck musculature, which has been shown to reduce the likelihood of a concussion, things of that nature. And all the equipment and stuff that the coaches are doing as well, it's all good progress towards what we want as an end goal, which is to end some head injuries. You know what I mean?
So but that's interesting.
Those accidental things are exactly what they are. Accidents.
Well, and I have a friend whose son got a bad concussion because he slipped on some black ice. So, you know, yeah. I mean, anything can happen. But that's interesting. So when we talk about, you know, your work as an athletic trainer, yeah. Teddy, now part of the training, it seems, is training your body so that it is better equipped when something happens
on
the field.
To react to the forces of getting hit on the field, to react to, I mean, building coordination so you don't have those instances where kids are just tripping and hitting their head from a whiplash injury. You know what I mean? It's huge to be able to react to things that you might not expect.
Very interesting. Dr. Glass, I'm going to give you the last word there.
Sure. Certainly, rules have been changed to bring in player safety. And anyone who ridicules those changes of the rules, saying that the game's not what it was, misses the whole point of the changes happen, and those changes come from scientific committees in that sport, not just the referee on the field. The referee is following the regulations that the committee came up with. It's to protect players. It's to protect citizens. It's to protect the people that have spent years, decades, trying to be good at what they're doing. So I think that that's part of the prevention. And sure, the game may be different, but it's probably safer. And that's why we're here today talking about it.
Well, I hope you guys come back in about a year. Maybe we'll look at new research, evolving practices. This has been great. Thank you so much. Dr. Glassman, thank you for your time.
Sure thing.
Dr. Stuart Glassman, rehabilitation medicine physician, medical director at Concord Hospital's Concussion Assessment and Management Program. Teddy Nutting, it was really nice to meet you. Thank you for being here. Teddy Nutting is Kennett High School's athletic trainer. Kennett is based in North Conway. And Mike Atkins, go Blackbirds. Thank you for making the trip over from Keene.
We'd love to come back.
Mike Atkins is director of athletics at Keene High School. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. Theme music was written by Bob Lord, and I'm Laura Canoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.